since nursing and healthcare is predominantly led by women leaders, it is important to spend a little bit of time on the issue of women and leadership. It's usually a very sensitive issue and one that raises all kinds of concerns and certainly personal and experiential problems, and sometimes some serious issues that represent gross discrimination and a certain level of social discrimination or embedded discrimination that has survived the centuries and lives even today. Issues of women's leadership affects certainly the profession of nursing, which is the single largest healthcare profession, but it also affects any other woman leader on her trajectory to higher levels of leadership and to personal leadership growth. So understanding some of the dynamics that relate to women's issues regarding leadership is really critical so that as a leader you can be aware of some of the accurate researched data-based issues that influence your own personal development as a leader. And for those of you who may be men listening to this podcast, in your relationship with other women leaders and in mentoring, developing, and leading women. Most of the contemporary research is codified and synthesized in a text called Through the Labyrinth, The Truth About How Women Become Leaders by Eagley and Carley. Also, there's a briefer discussion of women and leadership in the September 2007 issue of Harvard Business Review. We'll highlight some of the main themes affecting women's leadership from the perspective of Eagley and Carley, and allow that to kind of form a backdrop to some of your own further pursuit of women and leadership issues. It is important to be aware that these issues are operating as a backdrop to your own expression of leadership, and ignoring them is something that you will do at your own peril and in a way that will affect your long-term career viability. There's certainly no doubt that there is a serious and significant problem with regard to women in leadership. Women have made significant progress in leadership. As a matter of fact, they occupy more than 40% of all managerial positions in the United States. But at the highest levels of leadership in major organizations, hospitals, and health systems, they're still a relatively rare commodity. If you look at, for example, the most highly paid executives in the Fortune 500 companies, those who have titles such as chief executive or president or chairman or chief operating officer, only 6% of those are women. About 15% of those are women in healthcare organizations. Interesting with regard to healthcare is that 70 to 75% of the people who actually work in healthcare systems are women, while over 80% of those in C-suites who lead healthcare organizations are men. One can hardly assume that that is accidental or in some way unintentional. There is nothing accidental or unintentional about it. While it is insidious and certainly operates underneath the surface, it is clearly real and certainly as important and having as much an impact on contemporary women leaders as it has historically. While there are a number of feminist writers who have examined the role of women in society, very little has actually been examined with regard to specific characteristics of leadership and women leaders and the dynamics in the organization or workplace, especially within an American context, that affects the development of women for leadership roles. In 1986, the Wall Street Journal wrote that even those few women who rose steadily through the ranks eventually crash into an invisible barrier, the the glass ceiling. The executive suite seems within their grasp, but they just can't break through that glass ceiling. This metaphor was driven home by the authors Heimowitz and Schellhart in their article with an accompanying illustration that resonated, capturing the frustration of a goal within sight but somehow completely unattainable. Of course, in a historic context, there were plenty of opportunities to see evidence of absolute barriers to women's roles, from social, religious, political, and economic precedents. There has been a long history of masculine, male-dominated expectations for the role of leader, and if a woman became a leader, it was highly exceptional and often reflected masculine characteristics in the individual who became that leader. However, in the current age, times truly have changed, and the glass ceiling metaphor may not be as accurate as it once was. The glass ceiling clearly described a sense that there was an absolute barrier to the highest levels of leadership in organizations, but that absoluteness has certainly disappeared in the past couple of decades. And there are no roles, essentially, that are exclusive and should in any way be removed from the opportunity for women to hold them. So we've seen women as board chairs, chief executives, university presidents, state governors, even presidents of nations. As a matter of fact, the United States, as enlightened and as democratic a nation as we claim to be, is one of the few democratic nations of the 22 GATT nations where a woman has not held one of the highest elected offices in the country. Still, the metaphor does have impact because some of the assumptions that are made with regard to the metaphor is that men and women have equal access to entry and mid-level leadership positions. The evidence still suggests that they do not. There is a transparent obstruction that suggests that women are being misled about their opportunities because the impediment is not easy for them to actually see from a distance, and therefore they are led into believing and deluded into believing that there are more opportunities than in that arena than there actually are. But some impediments are not quite as subtle as some of those. Worst of all, by depicting a single kind of unyielding obstacle, the glass ceiling really fails to incorporate the high level of complexity and the wide variety of challenges that women face as they attempt to move along their own leadership trajectory. Women are affected all along the leadership continuum and are not just turned away at the last highest opportunity of leadership. So the insidiousness and complexity of the women's leadership journey operates as effectively at the early stages of leadership as it does at the higher levels of leadership. A more contemporary and perhaps more accurate model, the author suggests, for the journey of women leaders is the labyrinth. It's certainly an image that has a long and varied past and comes out of ancient cultures such as Greece, India, Nepal, even Native and North American cultures. As a contemporary symbol of the leadership journey of women, it generates a real clear and visual message of a highly complex, convoluted journey towards a worthy goal, but one that is difficult to obtain. The passage through the labyrinth is clearly not direct and certainly not simple, and does require strategy and tactics and good thinking and certainly a great deal of persistence, and requires along the way the ability to carefully analyze where you've been, where you are, what your reality is, and what lies ahead. What is important for men and women leadership is to understand as clearly as possible the various barriers that really make up the twists and turns of the labyrinth, and how some women can find their way through it and around it, and can work more effectively to achieve their goals. They can also create models and approaches and ways for other women to emulate and improve the situation for others just simply by clearly articulating how they have managed the labyrinth and how they've been able to break down some of the barriers that are contained within it. The first issues, of course, that all women need to deal with in the leadership trajectory are the vestiges of a long, long history of prejudice. It's a clearly well-established fact that men as a group still have the benefit of higher wages and faster promotions and greater benefits than women do in the workplace. Women enjoyed full-time work, but they only earned 81 cents for every dollar in 2005 that a man earned. Hundreds of studies, of course, have tried to search for the answer to this question. Perhaps the most comprehensive study of its kind was conducted by the U.S. Government Accountability Office in 1983 through 2000, looking at a representative sample of Americans. This long-term study showed that women earned about 44% less than men on average over the entire period from 1983 to 2000. The control factors that actually reduced this wage gap most were different employment patterns between men and women. Men undertook more hours of paid labor per year than women and had more years of job experience. Some interesting additional factors yielded some data that represented some of the issues of discrimination. For example, marriage and parenthood were associated with higher wages for men, but not for women. In contrast, other characteristics, especially years of education, had a more positive effect on women's wages than on men's. Even after adjusting wages for all the ways men and women differ, the GAO study, like many similar studies over the past two decades, showed that women's wages remained lower than men's under almost all circumstances. It is clear that the gender gap is consistent with the presence of long-term wage discrimination. Also, it is pretty clear that discrimination has affected promotions over the long term. Promotions come more slowly for women than for men with equivalent qualifications. One major and illustrative national study followed workers from 1980 to 1992 and found that white men were more likely to attain managerial positions than white women, black men, or black women. Controlling for other characteristics such as education and hours worked per year, this study showed that white men were far ahead of the other groups when entering the labor market, and that their advantage in attaining managerial positions grew throughout their careers. Other interesting research is simply underscored or advanced these findings. Even in culturally feminine settings, such as nursing or librarianship or elementary education and social work, men ascend to supervisory and administrative positions more quickly than women inside of these professions. And that's clearly been my own experience as a nurse and a professional. I found my leadership and management career trajectory moved relatively quickly and smoothly. I was embraced along the way, even if comparable competence with regard to roles was not evident between a woman seeking that role and myself, and also consistently received higher wages than my colleagues as women leaders. Even these correlational studies have been supported by experimental research where subjects were asked to evaluate hypothetical individuals as managers or job candidates, and all the characteristics of these individuals are held constant except for their sex. in these efforts, there is a continued tradition of what's called the Goldberg paradigm, which was named for a 1968 experiment by Philip Goldberg. His simple, elegant study has student participants evaluate written essays that were identical except for the attached male or female name on them. The students were totally unaware that other students had received identical materials ascribed to the writer of the other sex. This initial experiment demonstrated an overall gender bias. Women received lower evaluations unless the essay was on a feminine topic. Some 40 years later, unfortunately, experiments continue to reveal the same kind of bias in the work setting. Men are advantaged over equivalent women as candidates for jobs traditionally held by men, as well as for more gender-integrated jobs. Similarly, male leaders receive somewhat more favorable evaluations than equivalent female leaders, especially in roles usually occupied by men. It appears that this bias against women is not role-specific or ladder-specific. It operates the same way, in the same dynamic, whether they are low-level leadership roles or high-level leadership roles. The fact is that they are pervasive, and that evidence of discrimination is pervasive at every level of the organization. It's not a glass ceiling. It is simply gender-based discrimination, and the objective, experimental, and correlational studies over the last two decades undertaken to review this in great detail has simply validated this basic fundamental fact. So it's important to try and figure out what exactly is behind this discrimination that has been described by the research in the past two decades. It seems that there is a set of widely shared conscious and unconscious mental associations that Eagley and Carley identify in the research, related to women, men, and the leadership role. They indicate that study after study affirm that people associate women and men with different traits and link men with more of the traits that connote leadership. Kim Campbell, who was Prime Minister of Canada for a brief period of time, described the attention that results. Her description was, "I don't have a traditionally female way of speaking. Actually, I'm quite assertive. If I didn't speak the way I do, I wouldn't have been seen as a leader. But my way of speaking may have grated on people who were not used to hearing it from a woman. It was the right way for a leader to speak, but it wasn't the right way for a woman to speak. It goes against type." As psychologists see it, the clash is between two sets of associations, communal and agentic. Women are associated with communal qualities which convey a concern for the compassionate and loving treatment of others. These behaviors include especially compassionately related activities such as affection or helpfulness, friendliness, kindness, sympathy, as well as the roles that express interpersonal sensitivity, gentility, and soft-spokenness. Of course, when one views masculine or men-based roles, they're associated with agentic qualities, which convey assertion and elements of control. Now, these elements of control and assertion would include ambitious, aggressive, dominant, self-confident, and forceful behaviors, as well as a level of self-reliance and individualism. The agentic traits are also associated in most people's minds with effective leadership, perhaps because the long history of male domination of leadership roles makes it really difficult to separate the leaders' associations from associations of male behaviors and male characteristics. Studies looking at these differences in behaviors with regard to men and women engaging in dominant behavior find some really quite consistent data. Nonverbal dominance, such as staring at others while speaking to them or pointing at people, is considered more damaging behavior for women than for men. verbally intimidating others can undermine a woman's ability to influence, and assertive behavior can simply reduce her chance of getting a job or advancing in her career. Simply disagreeing can sometimes even get a woman in trouble. Men, of course, who disagree or otherwise act dominant get away with it and sometimes even are respected for it more often than women who are seen as intrusive or obstructive or aggressive. Self-promotion creates the same kind of dynamic when it's looked at in women. It certainly conveys status and competence and confidence, but it is not a communal value commonly associated with women. So men can self-confidence and bluster their way up to any number or any level of positions, whereas as a woman can be considered a career-terminating move. And there are, of course, double-bind ways of penalizing women by denying them really the full benefits of actually being warm and considerate. Certainly people expect it of women, and they require a nice behavior, and it's often noteworthy in men, but it is unimpressive and a part of the expectation you would see in women. In one study, helpful men reaped a lot of approval, but helpful women got no attention at all. Likewise, men got away with being unhelpful, but women were penalized for not being helpful. In another study, it found that male employees received more promotions when they reported high levels of helpfulness to co-workers, but female employees simply were ignored, and no promotions were related to such helpfulness. It was simply an expectation of their behavior. It was an exception when seen in the role of men. Because of this double bind, female leaders often struggle to cultivate an appropriate and effective leadership style, one that will work for them, that will be effective, that will have their appropriate impact, and will facilitate their own career trajectory. Trying to develop one that reconciles the communal qualities that people expect to see in women with the agentic qualities people think leaders need to succeed is very difficult. It's a major piece of work to try and make that happen. Nin Hua Cheng described her transition to the role of major symphony conductor. She said, "I used to speak more softly with a higher pitch. Sometimes my vocal cadences went up instead of down. I realized that these mannerisms lack a sense of authority. So I strengthened my voice. The pitch has dropped. I have stopped trying to be everyone's friends. Leadership is not synonymous with socializing." And if you listen to her voice, what you begin to see in the leadership role is a catch-22. The communal style is a part of the expectations of women's behavior, but on the leadership trajectory, to be successful at the communal style is to limit the agentic style necessary to exemplify strong leadership characteristics and to be able to assume the leadership role. When you do begin as a woman to really incorporate and to identify those roles in your own behavioral set, instead of being seen as a strong leader or a Jack Welch of your particular leadership category, you can often be seen as aggressive, as a bitch, as mean, and in some way not representing the values and expectations that you have of a woman and as a woman. The catch-22 creates difficulty in the trajectory towards leadership, if not making it virtually impossible. A meta-analysis of research styles indicated that female leaders were often more transformational than male leaders, especially when it came to giving support and encouragement to subordinates. Female leaders also engage more in rewarding behaviors than in directing and controlling behaviors. On the other hand, men exceeded women in transactional leadership skills that involved more corrective, disciplinary, and directive action, either active or passive. So men were more likely than women to be laissez-faire leaders who take little responsibility for managing and allow that to fall to the hands of others without much accountability or control. Women appeared to be the opposite with regard to those kinds of leadership characteristics. Also, for many women, if not most women, the most fateful turns of the labyrinth are the ones that are taken under pressure of the major responsibility for family issues. It is predominantly women who will interrupt their careers and take more time off and work part-time in the interest of supporting family obligations at a far greater rate than men see as a part of their role. As a result, they, by default, will have fewer years of job experience, fewer hours of employment per year, and all of the other factors related to making family responsibilities their unilateral predominant obligation and its impact on their career trajectory. In a major study of Chicago lawyers, for example, the researchers tried to get some understanding of why women were less likely than men to hold leadership partnership positions in large law firms. Those are the positions that are most high paid and confer the highest prestige and leadership obligation. What they found was that women were no less likely than men to begin their careers at such firms, but were more likely to leave them for positions in the public sector or for other corporate positions. Their departure was based on issues related to work-family trade-offs. Among the very few women who did become partners in a firm, 60% of those women had no children or other family obligations, and the minority who had children generally had delayed their childbearing years till much later. Even though we can now note that men are now increasingly sharing household and child-rearing responsibilities, the vast bulk of domestic work still falls to predominantly women. We know this from diary studies where people recorded what they were doing during each hour in a 24-hour day. In the United States, married women devoted 19 hours per week on average to housework in 2005, while married men contributed 11 hours. Much of that tradition of women and the household responsibilities is demonstrated that when women do work and do have a job, they really essentially have two jobs or two work shifts, one work shift that relates to their work job and then a second shift that relates to their family obligations, since the predominant obligation for undertaking family responsibilities still rests with the women predominantly. The final concern with regard to the challenges for women is one that relates to the underinvestment in the social capital that accrues from such non-essential parts of work that turn out actually to be quite essential in undertaking work. One significant study yielded the following description of managers who advanced rapidly in hierarchies. Fast-track managers spent relatively more time and effort socializing, politicking, and interacting with outsiders than did their less successful counterparts, and did not give much time or attention to the traditional management activities of planning, decision-making, and controlling, or to the human resource management activities of motivating, reinforcing, staffing, training, developing, and managing conflict. This, the author suggests, is social capital, and capital that is even more necessary to the manager's advancement than even the skillful performance of traditional managerial tasks. Given sufficient time, women can find it difficult to engage in and benefit from the informal networking that is so powerful and so important in growing networks and building a career trajectory. In these settings, these influential networks are composed entirely, or almost entirely, of men. And these men networks build liaisons of support which help advance men and give them an opportunity to build the kinds of coalitions and integrated work bodies and relational groups that can help them grow and expand fairly quickly. Breaking into those almost entire and dominant male networks can be hard, if not impossible, especially when these men center their networks on predominantly masculine activities. It is only if the woman can undertake these masculine activities, identify with them, or in some way relate to them, that she has any access to the relationship. But even then, when she can, if she overexcels, she creates a social cultural imbalance in the masculine mindset, resulting in fear and uncertainty with regard to subsequent relationships with this woman who might be more skilled, more adept, more talented, and more able to undertake these masculine activities. So even if she should be able to build these networks and to act comparably, the communal mindset of the appropriate role of the woman would prevent her from being successful enough in them to threaten the integrity and the dominance of men in that work group. So, knowing the real fundamental characteristics of the barriers that really affect a woman's trajectory, are there any accommodations or adjustments that can be made in order to help offset some of these difficulties and challenges? And there really is. And we as leaders, whether we be men or women leaders, need to be able to do as much as we can to create a balanced playing field so that an equitable foundation can be laid for developing good leadership across the board. Now, these activities need to move beyond legislation and laws and anti-discriminatory forces at the governmental and policy level. Analysis of discrimination cases that have gone to court have shown that legal remedies really can be quite elusive when gender inequality results from norms embedded deeply within organizational and personal structures and cultures. Really, the more effective approach for leaders and organizations is to really appreciate and understand and articulate the subtleties and the complexities of the problem, and to attack as many of the roots of the problem as possible. If an organization or leaders want to see more women arrive into the ranks of leadership, it really needs to undertake several activities. First, it needs to increase people's awareness of these complex psychological drivers of prejudice towards female leaders. Make them clear. Put them on the table. The clearer they are, the more transparent they are, the less fearful they are, and the more we can work towards addressing them objectively, raising the awareness necessary to really objectify these issues and develop strategies for compensating, adjusting, or overriding them is really critical. Second, changing the long hours norm for work, especially in the context of knowledge work. It really can be hard to assess an individual's relative contributions when managers use hours spent at work as the indicator of worth or value in the organization. The real value and indicator of worth in an organization is contribution, impact, a difference a person makes, not the number of hours that one spends. This notion of hours spent in busy activity as an indicator of both productivity and of value for knowledge workers is really inadequate and needs to be superseded, in fact, overcome, so that it is no longer a foundation for determining value. Third, in organizations, leaders need to reduce the subjectivity of performance evaluation. Performance evaluation clearly needs to be more objective, more accountability-based, more performance and outcome-oriented, so that we're looking not in terms of people's values, but in terms of people's contribution. There are a lot of effects of lingering prejudice in hiring and promotion and relationships. In order to be able to accommodate it as much as possible and to get as close to equity as one can, the criteria for evaluating performance should be explicit, and the evaluation processes should be based on contribution, on impact, on outcome, and the relationships, applications, and skills necessary to achieve it. Fourth, there's a need for organizations to use open recruitment tools such as advertising and employment agencies rather than relying on the informal social networks and on referrals, especially internal referrals for filling positions. So much of that is based on past patterns and practices and relationships, and needs to be overcome. So the more objective measurement orientation to fulfilling roles can be incorporated into bringing people into significant leadership roles, so that gender simply is not one of the considerations or one of the social cultural implications in filling people in positions of leadership over time. Fifth, we need in organizations to ensure a critical mass of women in executive positions, not just one or two women, to head off problems that come with tokenism. The goal is to establish as much equity as one can. You know, if organizations were truly configured to represent social balance and to represent equity, based on the distribution of knowledge, skills, and ability, and the number of women and men with those, we would be closer to a 50-50 distribution of women in positions of power than we currently are. Clearly, in healthcare, where 70% of those who provide healthcare services are women, and 80% of those who lead healthcare services are men, that imbalance is obviously prejudicial, obviously inappropriate. 50% is the minimum that should be attained at the senior levels of leadership in an organization in order to assure that equity has been achieved. And that critical mass for healthcare organizations should at a minimum be set at 50% in order to achieve equity. Six, avoid having sole female members in any team. Make sure that there is more adequate distribution of female members across teams, and more female representation in terms of the number of women that make up the workforce, so that there is a more adequate and equitable representation in teams, and more of the feminine value and membership on team activities. Also, seventh, organizations should help shore up the social capital. The call of family responsibilities is predominantly to blame for women's underinvestment in working and networking. When time is scarce, the social activity is the first thing to go by the wayside, yet it's one of the most important things along the leadership trajectory. This social capital, social equity with regard to responsibilities, family responsibilities, men's response to family conditions and situations shouldn't be gender-based, should be negotiated and based on contribution and value to the obligation. Eight, women should prepare for line management with appropriately demanding assignments. Women, you know, like men, must have the benefit of a developmental job experience. Mentoring, education, role development should be as available to women as it is to men, and they should have as much opportunity to take advantage of that development as men do. Ninth, human resource practices should be family-friendly for all roles, not for gender-based activities. Men and women should have an equal set of expectation for responding to family obligations and demands, and it should be a part of what is negotiated within the family network and condition itself. This is a long-term set of goals that will need to be undertaken in order to change the pattern of behavior that is so long-standing. So in families, in social situations, in organizations, in human resource practices, the expectation that men and women should have equal responsibility to respond to family obligations is really, really critical. 10. Women should be allowed to prove themselves worthy even if they have significant parental responsibility. This is particularly directed to organizations, many of them professional organizations. People not ready for promotion at the same time as the top performers simply are left in place. Sometimes, if they're left in place long enough, they are asked to leave their roles. But mostly mothers, while fully capable of reaching that level of achievement, need extra time to compensate in order to get there. This is necessary until that social balance between men and women and family responsibilities is achieved. So additional opportunities for women in order to compensate for the predominant family obligations of women needs to be initiated immediately in order to establish a long-term trajectory for changing women's roles. 11. Women should be welcomed back into the workplace. So when they do step out and meet family obligations or for other purposes, they should be welcomed back to the workplace and to begin where they left off in terms of their leadership development. Some companies have activated networks for keeping people on board, for keeping them in touch, keeping them involved and engaged. Doing that helps assure that continual processes will unfold in meaningful ways that will keep women empowered and engaged and involved in organizations in a way that represents significant value. And finally, encourage male participation in family-friendly benefits. If you make these benefits equitable, and men have the same benefits and opportunities for family obligations as women, the evidence suggests that they will take those obligations, and they will equitably share them when the expectation is clear, and the opportunity is clear, and the rewards are there for them. So these become social, political, and policy obligations of organizations and of leaders to create conditions of equity, to begin to build the social infrastructure necessary for equity to be a part of the predominant character of the organization and its way of doing business. Remember, whether you're male or female leaders, you are trying to dismantle the intensity of that labyrinth, straightening out those convoluted paths so that the opportunities available for women can be equated with those available to men, and that some of the barriers, both historic and organizational, structural and behavioral, can be broken down, repealed if possible, and in some way at least minimized in terms of their impact in preventing women from growing in the leadership pathway. If women are to achieve equality, women and men will have to share leadership equally, and organizations, structures, and leadership capacity will have to allow that to occur. As the authors indicate, with a greater understanding of what stands in the way of gender-balanced leadership, we draw nearer to attaining real balanced leadership when we can overcome these leadership issues and undertake the 12 strategies that were mentioned here to begin to create a much more level playing field and to advance the opportunities for women, which can only in the long term create an increasing benefit for the organization.